Hello, I'm Kate Saunders, and I will be asking Graham Swift a few questions. You don't, I'm sure, need reminding who he is, but he is, as John Banville has said, surely one of England's finest novelists. He's written seven novels, including Waterland, which was shortlisted for the Booker, won the Guardian Fiction Prize, and was made into a film. And his last novel was Last Orders, which won the Booker in 1996, was also made into a film. And his latest novel is called The Light of Day, and he'll be reading it, and then we'll be asking some questions. Ladies and gentlemen, Graham Swift.
Thank you very much, and welcome to what I think I am entitled to call a world premiere. Because this is actually the first time I have done a reading from this novel. And another way, I suppose, of putting that is to say that you're all guinea pigs. But whichever way you like to see it, thank you for being here. And basically, as you just heard, I'm going to read a few bits from the book, and then I'll be happy to answer questions from you and from Kate. All stories, by definition, I suppose, are things which happen after the event. And in this novel, this happens in a very precise way, because the present day of the novel is actually the anniversary, the second anniversary to be exact, of a significant, not to say terrible, event that's occurred in the past. And on this anniversary day, my central character and narrator, who's a man called George Webb, and he's a private detective and a former policeman, he's going to visit a woman in prison. And pretty early on in the novel, it emerges that this woman, she's called Sarah Nash, is a former client of George's, and that George has been faithfully visiting her for, well, throughout this two-year period. It also pretty soon emerges why Sarah is in prison, what crime she has committed. So whatever else the novel does, it follows the course of a single day which revolves around a prison visit. But it does do a lot else, including going back over the crucial events of 2 years before. And they started, as far as George was concerned, when Sarah first appeared in his office as a potential client. So the first bit I'd like to read is from the beginning of the novel, where George is thinking back to that first encounter. Just so that you have your bearings, the novel is set in 1997, so here we're thinking back to 95, and it's physically set where George has his office in Wimbledon. Something happens. Something comes over us, we say. We cross a line. We open a door we never knew was there. It's 2 years ago now, a little more. A day in late October, crisp and clear, sunshine from the window over my desk. Rita opened my door and said, "Mrs. Nash." I was on my feet as usual, buttoning my jacket. Most of them have got no comparisons to go on. It's their first time. It must feel like coming to a doctor. They expected something shabbier, seedier, more shaming. And the tidy atmosphere Rita's doing, it surprises them, it reassures them. There's even a vase of flowers. "Mrs. Nash, please, have a seat." And I could be some high street solicitor, a fountain pen in my fingers, doctor, solicitor, marriage guidance counsellor. You have to be a bit of all three. And there was the usual look of plucked up courage, swallowed back hesitation. And then she says, "My husband is seeing another woman." Well, there aren't so many ways of saying it, but you have to look as if you haven't heard it said in every possible way. They're all unique. The only one to have to come to the doctor with this rare complaint. I see, I said. I'm sorry. Can I offer you some coffee, tea? A doctor. A specialist. You're already gauging the symptoms. At any moment now, there could be tears, curses, fireworks, waterworks. They all come with a script, fully rehearsed. At some point, all gets abandoned. And this was something I never expected. But this would be the most absorbing, the most rewarding part of the job. Things that they never taught you in the police. She didn't want coffee or tea. Although Rita, I knew, was outside, like a nurse with the emergency trolley, ears pricked, kettle primed, ready to rush in with a tray at a moment's notice. I said, "You know or you think?" "I know," she said. Well, no hesitation there. She had eyes that seemed to shift under a slight frost, from black to brown. The hair was the same. It was black, you'd say, but when that sunlight from the window caught it, you saw it was deep brown. Another thing I never expected, although it's obvious, you only have to think, it was mostly women, say 60%. And some of them, they don't just come in with their lines rehearsed, they come in as if for a full-blown audition, as if they spent the last 2 hours in front of a mirror, dressed to kill, clouds of scent. They don't want you to think that it's for that reason, that it's out of neglect. They've made their decision, but they've got their pride. Doctor, solicitor, casting director. But she wasn't one of the star turns. She'd done her face, I guessed, in that hasty, automatic way of women who don't need to slap it on like war paint. She didn't need to, although she might be going to war. And of course you think of the husband. You think, what's going on here? You put yourself in the husband's shoes, and that's just what they know you'll do. Early 40s, 42, 43, in good shape. The eyes with just their touch of frost. Clever eyes. The frost making them look a bit stern, but you could imagine them melting. And she was a teacher, it turned out, a college lecturer, used to running a show. And teachers, well, even on day release when I was in the force, they always used to give me the willies. Clever, comfortably off, an easy ride through life, probably, till now. So the frost was thin. "I see," I said. "So you know who the woman is?" She'd undone her coat, but hadn't taken it off. And she was carrying a bag, a plain black soft leather bag, which she'd unhooked from her shoulder and let slip to the floor. And the flaps of her coat fell open. And that bar of sunshine from the window just caught her knees, gave them an almost tinsely sheen. They didn't seem like the usual knees of women that can stick out from a skirt with all kinds of angles and meanings. They were just knees, caught in the light. It was her knees, maybe. She said yes. "Her name is Christina. Christina Lazic." "Well, that sounds foreign," I said. "Can you spell that?" "She's from Croatia." I pulled my notebook towards me. There's a point where it helps to get brisk. "And do you know where your husband and Miss Lazic, is it Miss, where they meet?" "Yes, it's Miss." "Yes, I can give you the address. It's a flat in Fulham. We rent it for her. I mean, Bob, my husband, rents it for her." "I see. And before this," she said, "before she lived in the flat, she used to live under our roof." "I see." I sensed her watching my pen move over my pad as if I was being slow. And you'd like me to keep your husband and Miss Lazidge under observation? You'd like me to establish evidence? No. 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 You see, it's all over. It's all over. She's going back to Croatia in 3 or 4 weeks. It's been agreed. She's getting a plane. What I want you to do is to follow them to the airport. Watch them. That's all. Let me get this clear, Mrs. Nash. It's all over. You mean it's all over between your husband and Miss Lazick?
Yes.
But you said them. Follow them. You mean your husband's going to take Miss Lazick to the airport?
Yes.
To see her off. It's a last concession. But if it's all over, if she's leaving, why do you want me to follow them? The first real pause, the first slight quiver of the lips. She looked like someone owning up to something. To see if she really goes. To see if they really go to the airport. And if they do. See if she really gets the plane, I mean, by herself. See if they don't just fly off together somewhere. Anywhere, any plane. Will you do this for me? Will you follow them and watch them and tell me what happens? As if she was suddenly begging some friend. Of course, I said. And I was thinking, jobs don't come much easier. Money for old rope. I might have handed it over to Rita. But I saw the glitter in her eyes. Sometimes they gush, explode. Sometimes there's just this wetness in the eye. It can lead on to other things, but if it doesn't, you have to pretend it isn't there. And all the time, she'd been holding on to the strap of that bag, like some pet on a leash. Of course I can, Mrs. Nash. No problem. But I need some details. Date and time of the flight, the intended flight. Are we talking about Heathrow? And that address you mentioned, is that where they'll be driving from? In your husband's car? What does he drive? The tears didn't spill. They didn't dry out. And I'll need photos of each of them, if you can manage that, for recognition purposes. Sunlight streamed between us. That stickiness had left her eyes, but she looked for a moment simply lost. Although they all look like that. As if they'd come on purpose, but now they seem to be here by accident. A mistake. Wrong door. For a job like this, Mrs. Nash, I won't ask you to sign anything. And I won't assume I'm hired until I get your precise instructions. And the rule is, for obvious reasons, you contact me, I don't contact you. They blink, a bit startled. They've already entered a conspiracy, a pact. They come in the injured party, they walk out in a sort of guilty daze. I said you can send the photos or bring them in if you prefer. She seemed to have got stuck to that chair. She still clutched the strap of that bag. Someone someday should write a book about handbags. Maybe they have. About how women cling to them, as if they're their closest friend, when all else fails. And the things you find inside them. I've lost count of how many I've rifled through. But where she is now, I can't have handbags. The strap. And now, of course, I have that bag, along with all the other things. In my safe keeping. And yes, it is like a pet. I've stroked it, talked to it. Inside, all the contents of a precise day, 2 years ago now. She clutched that strap as if she was waiting for the bag to get up first. So, I said, unless there's anything else, like the full story, the whole story. But they don't have to tell you that. You don't have to know. I held out my hand through that shaft of sunshine. She managed to stand. Moments later, I went to the window to see if I could catch her crossing the street. As if, just by looking, I might have stopped her stumbling into the path of some car. And there she was, maroon for a moment on the traffic island, the sun on her hair. And then Rita came in, saw me looking. Rita was always doing her private assessments, my female clients. She was one once. But I'd never done this before, gone to the window to look. She'd have noted that, definitely. She's a good detective, doesn't miss a trick. And later that week, she said, "Something's come over you, George." And indeed it had. Well, George gets the job. Sarah doesn't change her mind, and he doesn't hand it over to Rita. So, what happened on that fateful night when he followed Bob, the husband, and Christina, the girl, to the airport? And Christina, by the way, was a former student of Sarah's, who, coming from the former Yugoslavia, was first orphaned by the events in that part of the world, and then required to become an asylum seeker, at which point Sarah and Bob agreed to take her in to their own home, with the best of charitable intentions, but obviously with unfortunate consequences. Well, George follows the two to the airport, where, indeed, he sees Christina go through to departures to catch a plane by herself, leaving Bob alone. And George then, as agreed, phones Sarah to say, "Everything's fine, the girl's gone, Bob will be coming back to you." And, of course, at that point, this very simple job of his is over. But George has already formed a certain feeling for Sarah. And he's seen, as Sarah hasn't seen, that Bob is a distraught man, a man who's watched his lover walk away. So George decides that to complete the job, he should follow Bob back home, make sure he gets there safely. And this journey back is not without its complications, but in the end, Bob drives into the quiet, leafy, comfortable street in Wimbledon where he and Sarah live. It's called Beecham Close. And from the corner of that street, George even watches Bob drive into his own front drive. And then George turns away, drives off himself, his job now well and truly over, to go home. But before he gets there, he has this sudden premonition that something terrible is going to happen. Turns the car around, drives back, to discover that, yes, indeed, something terrible has happened. The police are there just ahead of him. And this simple-seeming job of his, this money-for-old-rope job, has turned into a murder case. And thus, of course, my novel is in part a murder story, but not really in the usual sense, because we pretty soon know who did it. The mystery is more in why and exactly how. And this novel gradually reveals, and of course it does it through its narrator, George, but George was only a partial witness to some of the events involved. And although he's been talking to Sarah, we don't really know how much Sarah might have told him. So what we glean really through George's half-informed but intensely and intimately concerned speculation about what happened. And this is what the next passage I'm going to read is about. Here, George is thinking back to that night, but he's doing so from the point of view of Sarah, from the point of view of a woman who is waiting for the return of her husband in more than one sense. And there's just one other thing you need to know about George. A divorced man living on his own, he had recently discovered a bit of a talent for cooking. The Nash case. It became a story, as well as a case. It made the papers. Nothing major, soon gone and forgotten, but a small splash, if splash isn't an unfortunate word. Most murders aren't news. They happen all the time. And mostly ask an old cop their bleak, grim, depressing affairs that happen in some place where murders happen. A war somewhere far away. A body weeks old dumped in a patch of waste ground. And pity the poor cop who has to deal with such stuff and then go back to a nice, clean home, a wife, a kid. But when it happens in the first place, in a nice, clean home, not just a nice, clean home, but a pricey pad in the leafiest, choicest part of Wimbledon, there's something just a bit pleasing about the disasters of the well-off. Look, even they don't screw it up. Even they don't lead charmed lives. So we didn't feel so jealous after all, let alone feel sorry for them. So he was knocking off this foreign girl. Where was she from? And she, the wife, didn't like it. Well, poor her. Poor her with her luxury kitchen. And she didn't have to do it in the first place, did she? Take that girl in, give her shelter. Stupid bitch. And him, a gynecologist, raking it in. You can't help having the thought. Wasn't he the one who should have had women under his knife? A story. Stabbing. A stabbing is always good. Nice, juicy stabbing. A kitchen knife. She was a college lecturer and a translator. Words were her thing. But she went and picked up a knife. And on top of all that, the extraordinary fact, the mystery, that she did it on the very night that he'd said goodbye to the girl. Where was she from again? He'd seen her onto a plane. He was coming back to her, his wife. Everything was going to be as it was. And for God's sake, she'd got all dressed up to welcome him. She was dressed, but don't say it, to kill. At that very point. Mystery? It was all a setup. A plan. The heat of the moment. Pull the other one. And he'd had it coming, you might say. Although not exactly that. She waits till he thinks he's safe. Till he thinks he's made his peace. And then, wham. Murdering bitch. An ash cake. It had all the ingredients. Top gynecologist slain by wife. If ingredients isn't an unfortunate word, since she was cooking a meal at the time, it's how that kitchen knife came in. And wasn't this the weirdest thing? It was his favourite meal. She said so, swore it. A meal that never got eaten, never got served. But all the time she was waiting for him, all the time his last minutes were ticking away, he didn't know that. She was cooking him his favourite meal, coq au vin. So how did that fit in with the plan? The heat of the moment, the heat of the kitchen. She was a good cook. She loved to cook. And with a kitchen like that. And that last meal, there's no doubt about it, was lovingly, meticulously prepared. Coq au vin. It needs time, plenty of time. Strictly speaking, for best results, more time than even Sarah gave it. But then there was the element of surprise. A day in advance is best, so the whole thing can cook and then rest and then cook again. I know a bit about these things. But she began her task. Did Marsh, the officer in charge, ever ask her? Early that afternoon, around the time that Robert Nash made his way to the flat in Fulham where Christina Lazic was waiting for him. While the two of them were in bed together for the last time, either that or preparing to flee, Sarah Nash would have been jointing a good quality small chicken. Forget a real cock in Wimbledon. She'd have set aside shallots, garlic, dark gilled mushroom, streaky bacon. She'd have diced the bacon into little chunks, amounts for two. She'd have known that there was a chance, a real chance, and it's how it turned out, but in a different way, that this meal would never be eaten, would go to waste. But it was as though, and I can understand this, its very preparation, its intention, would bring about the outcome she wished. In the careful and loving cooking of a meal, there is, I believe this too, a sort of healing power. His favourite meal, and by association, hers. They'd first eaten coq au vin together, so she'd tell me later, in France, on the first ever trip they took together, when they were falling in love. And she'd have thought about that trip maybe right then, on that November afternoon, already growing dark, as she set aside, of course, that other principal ingredient, the wine. A bottle of bone, since, although the wine's for cooking, not any old plonk will do. A mistake to skimp on the wine. The better the wine, in fact, it's half the secret. The better the coq au vin. And later on, she'd have placed a bottle of the same wine, only fitting, on the table in the corner of the kitchen, where a little half-partition with a countertop, cupboards, shelf or two of books underneath, formed a separate little cosy alcove, along with the glasses, the napkins, the vase of flowers, and the candle. She'd have opened the bottle for breathing, it's my guess, a little after my call from the airport. She's gone. It's okay. He's coming home. But waited a little longer, maybe, before she lit the candle. But earlier that afternoon, she was only beginning the ritual process of cooking a classic meal, browning the chicken joint, trying at that early stage not even to think, to hope, to guess. It's another thing that cooking undoubtedly does, if you don't rush it. It soothes the nerves, occupies the mind, stops it pointlessly roaming. And it would have served that calming function as best it could, until come the evening, when everything would soon be made clear, when I'd already followed that black Saab into the entrance tunnel at Heathrow. She couldn't have prevented herself looking at the clock, at the telephone, or prevented her stomach from tying itself in knot. You cook, you're not hungry yourself. That's sometimes how it is. But then the call had come, at 7:10 by my watch and by the clocks in Terminal 2, and it must have seemed, after all, that all that preparation had worked. At that point, after wiping away tears, after opening the bottle and breathing deeply herself, she'd have returned to the simple task of cooking as if it were an act of celebration. Not that there was much to do. Time, slow heat. She might already have removed the chicken pieces to thicken the liquid. A little flour and butter were stim. And then return them to the pot and the gentlest simmer. She'd set aside vegetables. With coq au vin, you don't want much. A few small potatoes, a dish of French beans, some nice crusty bread. She'd made a pudding, poached pears. They'd been left to cool. A wedge of nice cheese, some red grapes. All never to be touched. And she'd have laid the table. Now it was safe. The same table where once she'd hugged a sobbing, just-arrived Christina. And Christina, by then, would have been boarding her plane. At some point, after a tidy-up and a quick glance round, she'd have gone upstairs to change. The sudden coolness of even a well-heated house when you leave the kitchen. November, darkness outside. She put on, so the police would observe, a simple but stunning scoop-neck dress of black velvet. A dress for an evening out, though this was an evening in. And she chose from the box on the dressing table a pearl necklace, no doubt, but I know it now, a present from him. A simple question. Do you get dressed like that if you mean to? And now I run it all back through my head, as if I was there, there in that bedroom. This seems almost the most unbearable moment. The last time, though, she didn't know it, that she'd do this, make herself ready. Those practiced, almost unthinking and recently just token actions, now once more done with meaning, even a touch of triumph. All that Christina might have had to offer, not anymore. She touched up her hair, her face. Lipstick, scent. The last time she'd do these things this way. The last time she'd know even the commonplace pleasure of a bedroom, a dressing table, a special dress. And Mrs. Nash, the papers would note it. Marsh, the officer in charge, would note it. Was a striking woman, if that's not an unfortunate word. I should have been in that bedroom, fastening that necklace, fastening that dress. It was nearly 8, perhaps, by then. She came back downstairs. Now all her agony had condensed into a single minor uncertainty. When would she hear the car, his step? The key in the door. She knew it could be a while. Traffic, a weekday night. Heathrow to Wimbledon, it can take longer than you think. She knew she might need this last scrap of patience. In the hallway by the window, she'd have checked the porch light, the light over the garage, and those little low lights at the entrance to the drive were all on. Of course they were. She'd have eyed herself in the mirror. The way we can look at ourselves as if we haven't met for a while. And Bob, did she wonder? Would it be like meeting him all over again? She'd have gone back into the kitchen. She'd have been doubly careful now to put on the apron, the proper wraparound cook's apron, navy blue with a white stripe, that was found when the police arrived, bundled loosely onto the worktop, where she must have flung it quickly when she heard him arrive. One of the cops, a tasteless joke, she should have kept it on. But there's still been things to do. Final touches, a last taste, a last stir, a last adjustment of the heat. And there was the parsley to chop for the garnish. And perhaps it was at this point, not waiting after all till she heard the car, that she lit that candle. So that when the police arrived, they walked into a scene that was not at first, until you saw the obvious, like a murder scene at all. The opposite. A scene of perfect welcome. A warm, inviting house on a cold November night. And a house that smelt, that breathed. This was the really striking thing. Of something wonderful cooking. You couldn't help smelling it as soon as you walked in. The smell of good cooking that goes straight from nose to stomach and from stomach to heart. Look, it was still there. Still on the gentlest simmer. It hadn't been touched. Someone took it upon themselves to turn off the heat. And someone, after Mrs. Nash had been taken away, but the body, her husband, was still there, might even have raised the lid and looked, sniffed. There was a wooden spoon close by. Did they dare? And over there, in the corner, the candle, the flowers, the napkins, the unpoured wine. Even the murder weapon, a kitchen knife, a good one recently sharpened, still had on it, along with Bob Nash's blood, some green smears and flecks of parsley. A private detective. Me. Who blundered madly in. Noted all of this too. The Nash case. How could it have been cold-blooded revenge? But if not revenge, then what? On that very night, at that very point, she hadn't planned an escape, a getaway. The opposite. She herself made the call, said the words. And there she was, still there, saying it over and over again. I did it. I did it. I did it. As if she was learning a new language. As if someone should have been there to translate. She put down the knife. She put it back on the chopping board. Revenge? He had it coming. But who was the real monster now, the real monster of the two? He was just the gynecologist who crossed the line, who'd taken advantage, if it was that way round, of a poor, helpless refugee girl. No, he didn't look so pretty. But who was the real monster now? But go back. Go back to that kitchen before it was the scene of a crime. Before it was a case, a story in the press. Rewind the clock. Relive it. Though, how do the dead relive?
Pinch myself and tell myself how lucky I am, and there are plenty of unfortunate people, invisible people, who are in locked-up situations out there. And
but isn't this your fiction, though? You're always trying to give a voice to the invisible, the so-called ordinary.
Well, yeah, I'd hope so. I'd hope so. I certainly don't. I don't want to write fantastic stuff, spectacular stuff. I start with the world that I know, the ordinary world that I know, and in that there are plenty of discoveries to be made. There's plenty to be revealed in the ordinary world.
Making my sweep of the room again.
Can you start with an idea, like you just said, that a man is invisible when in prison. And all your novels start with just simple questions, and then you just expand. Like Last Orders, is that some idea occurred and then you just work out from there?
How novels begin is a very mysterious thing, and I think it's a pretty messy thing, to be honest. You never have a clear sense of it at the time. In this case, it was a situation, the one I've described. I think in some other cases, it can be something even smaller, and sort of like a little fragment of something. But I think the key feature is my feeling that whatever it is, there is a bigger story to be discovered around it, the fragment or the situation. And don't ask me why it is those particular things that sort of bug me to make the story out of them. It just is. It's a bit like dreaming. I mean, you don't know what you're going to dream, but some dreams can be rather haunting. And I think it's the same at the beginning of the novel. The question is about being adapted for film. Obviously, I'm not against the idea, because it's happened. But on the other hand, I don't write to be made into film. I write novels to be novels, these things that happen on the page. And I, as I've said before now, I think the page is a much bigger and more magical thing than the cinema screen. I have had the experience of two novels being turned into film, and I think I'm extremely lucky because they have both been not bad experiences. And one can look around and find any number of examples of travesties of adaptations. And neither the film of Waterland nor the film of Last Orders was a travesty. I think they were both decent films. And in the case of Last Orders, what a fabulous cast, and you know, so much going for it, very respectfully, very sincerely made. I didn't have a role in the actual adaptation process, but I did know the director, who also wrote the screenplay, this is in the case of Last Orders, got on with him, and when they were actually filming it, I was often, because a lot of it happened not far from where I live, I was often around to watch it, and the whole process was extremely friendly. So I'm in an unusual position for a writer, I think, to say good things about film adaptations. Yes.
Can I just ask why you picked the years 95 and 97 to set the story in? I was wondering whether it was a deliberate attempt to distance yourself from more recent political events that might have cast a shadow of some sort.
No. I think, certainly in my case, novels take a number of years to write. So there is no such thing in my case, and I think no such thing anyway, as a contemporary novel. Because once you finish the novel, the contemporary events which you started with are already history. So I think the date 97 partly reflects just that, you know, that it would be impossible to publish a book in 2003 which was about the events of 2003 or even 2002. If you tried that, I think it wouldn't be a very good novel. And it had to be the 90s for certain other reasons, like the Croatia, Yugoslavia, that had to fit in. It was a perfectly comfortable time for me to be writing about, and when I began the novel, it was actually pretty recent anyway.
That's right up the back.
Why was there such a long delay since writing Last Orders to the latest novel?
I don't think I used the word delay. Why? Why do you say delay? It just took the time it took. The time is taken up by a number of things. One of which I have to say is living. You know, I don't just write, I live as well. Last Orders was a pretty successful novel, and one of the effects of its success was that I was involved for effectively nearly 2 years of doing stuff about that book. I don't mean solidly for 2 years, but I mean doing things on and off for a two-year period, so I could never get my concentration back. I could never really sit down and write. And I didn't have anything brewing anyway, so I then had to find my next novel. And novels don't drop into your head very often. And in any case, I think I have become, if I can put it this way, a better rejecter of my own work with each novel, and that means that I write a lot and throw it away, and the public sees what I'm happy for the public to see. They don't see all the stuff where I made false starts and abandoned and all of that. So a lot of that went on. So that's how it is for me. Not a delay at all, just carrying on, you know. The lady in the second from the back row. A recurring theme in my novels. I think we might have just touched on, it's not exactly a recurring theme, but a recurring, what do we call it, motif of the locked up person being visited. I think that's too broad and too abstract a question for me to honestly come up with an answer. And I don't think, actually, I don't think in terms of themes. I don't, when I'm contemplating a novel, I don't think I want to write a novel with a theme of X or Y. It's not how it happens. I'll come back to you, but I think there was a hand up. That's right, gentleman over there.
in this book, as in several of your early books, but much more than many other writers, you cut time and story up into a very large number of pieces. And in reassembling them, you use putting together events which were occurred at different times as a very vital part of managing development of the story. Is that difficult to do? If so, what are the actual mechanics?
Anyone not hear the question? It's all about how I deal with time, which is in a very unstraightforward and un-insequential way, non-sequential way. It's the way I do it, and so to some extent it is my natural way of doing it, so it's not a labour. I don't find it difficult. I think I would honestly find it more difficult and certainly less exciting to write a narrative which is just straight and then and then and then sequence. And I think one reason why I jump around in time, to put it like that, is I think it's what we all do anyway. It's what our memories do. And the most intimate way in which we deal with the past, with our personal past, through our own memory, is not at all logical and sequential. And we all know this. We remember things one moment from a recent period, and then suddenly something flashes back from years ago. And there might be some connection. So I don't think it would be straining things too much to say that my narrative behavior, I don't even think of it as a technique, my narrative behavior is a bit like the behavior of memory.
I'm terribly sorry, but we are going to have to wind up there. Can I just say, Graham's books are on sale at the bookshop at a handsome discount, and he will be in here signing them. And it only remains for me to say, Graham Swift, thank you very much.
Thank you.